much. Mark Garrison with the headlines. And as Mark reported there, there's a positive sign in the Middle East this morning with the turnover of the Green Zone to Iraqi forces in Baghdad, but also a tense situation in Gaza between Palestinians and Hamas and Israel. Joining us this morning is Patrick Tyler, former reporter for The Washington Post and The New York Times, and author of a fascinating new book, A World of Trouble, The White House and the Middle East, From the Cold War to the War on Terror. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Pat, thanks for joining the program.
Happy to be here.
And Happy New Year to you. And in many ways, you know, the Middle East, of course, is a story of the region. It's a story of very ancient places and, you know, longstanding conflicts. But in the post-war era particularly, the story of the Middle East is an American story. And I guess in reading your book, I'm surprised that this narrative hasn't been written earlier. It's a fascinating window on the Middle East that if you read books about the Middle East, you just get pieces of. What made you think, and you've been a longtime reporter in this region, both on the White House side and the Middle Eastern side, that this narrative was a key narrative not only about the Middle East, but about America itself?
Well, having served in the region and having puzzled over how best to convey to a new reader, a young person, someone interested in reading in on the Middle East for the first time, you put your finger on it, how to organize the region to tell the story and to find a narrative thread that ties it all together. And I guess what I stumbled upon finally in looking at it, having traveled the place, is not to do it geographically, but to look at it from the American perspective, the perspective of the agenda that we create through our presidency and through, you know, our decision-making process, our own governance, and our own engagement of the region. So the agenda of each president over the decades, and to line them up together so you can see how they can compare.
And the contrasts are fascinating. I want to get into some individual stories, but I think broadly, if we look at this narrative, I see two big themes, and both of them, quite frankly, are sad. The first, that America's decline is really depicted here. You have Eisenhower dictating to both sides in the Suez Crisis, and today you have, in the War on Terror, an almost marginalized United States. And the second narrative, which may be even sadder, is that since the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin in Israel, it really seems to me, and your book conveys this in a really compelling way, that the radicals on both sides are really driving the forces in the Middle East.
I think it is sad but true. I think that's a good characterization of it. First of all, on the first point of U.S. decline, you have to remember that after World War II, General Eisenhower, when he stepped up and engaged the region, having been the war commander and being a very popular president in the wake of world wars that had killed millions of people and the creation of great new multilateral institutions like the United Nations that were teed up to prevent wars and resolve conflicts in the future, is that he had an enormous mandate, an enormous amount of capital, political capital, in the international community to work together to resolve conflicts in the because of the looming shadow of the war that had been so devastating. And so the multilateralism of that period, really before the Cold War kicked in and threw a wrench into so many efforts to work jointly in the international community, before that really undermined cooperation later on, the Eisenhower period was a brief moment where you could coalesce, even though there were great exceptions to that, but there was a great deal of cooperation.
Well, much of the sort of meat of the book is this transition between Nixon-Kissinger and what became the historic Carter Camp David moment in U.S. Middle East relations. I'm surprised in the 1973 crisis how much Kissinger was really being driven, it seems, in your reporting, by the Israeli agenda and almost on a tactic-by-tactic way. Can you recall a particular story that conveys how Kissinger was really almost responsible for resupplying the Israelis in 1973?
I think the way you have to look at that is the political pressure that was on the White House at the time. Watergate was about to unhinge Nixon, and the Senate of the United States became the most important body to the White House. And the Senate was very concerned about what was happening to Israel, whether Nixon was going to resupply the Phantoms that are getting shot down at the rate of 6 or 10 per day, because the Egyptian air defenses, with manned by Soviets, were working so well. So it was a very tough period, and Kissinger was terrified that there would be blowback from the Senate against him personally, and he was trying to survive the Nixon collapse. And therefore, he was extremely attentive, and there became an alliance, really a back-channel alliance, between him and Simcha Dinitz, who was the Israeli ambassador at the time, and the declassification of his phone conversations with the Israeli leadership during this time shows that Kissinger was working extremely hard not to, to enable the war goals of Israel toward the end, as they were trying to surround the Egyptian army and cut it off. Because they wanted their piece of the victory, too. They did not want the Yom Kippur War to end without them looking like they had, taken the initiative and pulled a victory.
Mm-hmm.
out of the war that had started with this dramatic crossing of the Suez Canal by the Egyptians. Kissinger worked very closely during that crisis, first of all, that started with Nixon setting the tone that says, we are not going to feed this war. The Americans and the Soviets both wanted to restrain their clients. But what you find is Kissinger working over a period of time to undermine that because of the drastic domestic political problem of Watergate.
Well, Patrick, your book covers an extraordinary continuum, and I'm just wondering, given that continuum and the last 8 years under the Bush administration, where has that left the U.S. in terms of its affluence as a power for peace in the Middle East?
I think we're in a tough spot. We've gone through 8 years in which our credibility and basic trust of many nations of our stewardship as a mediator in the world has declined, and I think obviously you can see what most people can see, that there's a great opportunity for a new administration to pick up the mantle and to restructure the American role. Gaza is a great example of that. I mean, it is a shame to see that people making points that the militarization of the crisis again is something that is helping Israel restore its deterrent factor. Well, that's not really where we should be 60 years on into this conflict. We should be about getting security and then a framework for negotiation to bring the Palestinians together and to get a peace framework that creates the Palestinian state that everybody says they want.
Well, it's the real question for the Barack Obama administration. Will Barack Obama be more like Kissinger, Nixon, more like Carter? It's an open question, and to explore it, one should only look at A World of Trouble, The White House in the Middle East, From the Cold War to the War on Terror, written by Patrick Tyler. Patrick, happy New Year, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Former reporter for The Washington Post and The New York Times.
And here's your takeaway, the first one for 2009.
They've already moved into the Republican Palace, which the embassy moved out of. But in terms of major changes, that's going to come down the line, I think.
That's Campbell Robertson, an Iraq war correspondent for The New York Times, talking about the new status of forces agreement that begins today between the U.S. and Iraq. It's January 1st, 2009, New Year's Day, and we've talked about Southern traditions to bring you good luck. What are you doing to bring yourself good luck? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. We want to hear your story. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.